KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
All right,
this is Carolyn here.
Great, go ahead, Carolyn.
So I was able to restart the program on the one computer, but the public view for AV capture, that one's still kind of frozen. So you're free to continue the meeting, but for those viewing at home on AV capture, there'll be a slight moment where I have to restart that computer. So everything's good.
Great.
Hey Carolyn.
Yeah.
Be on the look for Apple Martine. When she joins, she'll have,
okay.
Could you bring her over also?
Sure will.
Thank you.
And Willie as well, of course. All right. There he is. Great. Thanks everyone for bearing with us with a few little technical difficulties this morning, but welcome to KPTZ listeners, Dr. Berry, our health officer, and Willie Bentz, our Department of Emergency Management. So hand it over to you, Dr. Berry, to kick us off.
Thank you so much. Nice to see everybody again. So on the COVID front, we are starting to see the beginning of COVID-19 cases leveling off nationwide. Certainly we're seeing the initial spikes in the South start to go down. Current highest rates are in Tennessee at the moment. We're starting to see the beginning of leveling off, which is good, but we are leveling off at a very high rate still. So currently, we are now continuing to see deaths rise, as we've discussed before. Deaths tend to follow a couple weeks behind cases and hospitalizations. Currently, there are approximately 1,600 Americans dying of COVID-19 daily. About 650,000 so far have died due to the infection. In Washington, we are continuing to see somewhat of a disparate response across the state. Statewide, we're seeing cases start to level off, particularly led by kind of the I-5 corridor is leveling off, but the east side of the mountains is continuing to rise. In our area, we are still seeing case rates rise, but they are rising more slowly. We are starting to see, so that curve really shot up, and we're starting to see it start to curve towards a leveling. So we are cautiously optimistic about that. In Jefferson County, we have diagnosed 871 cases of COVID-19. The current case rate in the last 2 weeks is 533 per 100,000, so still higher than it was last week, but not skyrocketing up the way that it was before. We have 4 people currently hospitalized with COVID-19 for a total of 56 hospitalizations in this response. And unfortunately, we have had 13 deaths. We had quite a few last week, largely related to a large long-term care facility outbreak that we are working on. In Clallam County, we are seeing case rates start to level off, still at an incredibly high rate. Our current case rate in Clallam County is 1,209 per 100,000. So still incredibly high, but at least flat compared to where it was before. And we are cautiously optimistic that we can see that start to turn down. But we are monitoring 4 long-term care facility outbreaks in Clallam. And so those certainly can drive hospitalizations. In Kitsap County, we are still seeing cases rise. They didn't rise as quickly as we did. So they're at 542 per 100,000 now, but they're continuing to go straight up. So we're monitoring Kitsap as that is often where we would transfer patients if they were quite ill. Hospital capacity in Washington State remains incredibly strained. We have currently 35 ICU beds in the entire state available. So as far as transferring our very sick people out from Jefferson County, that is still very, very difficult to do. That's driven, as we've discussed before, primarily by COVID-19 cases at this point, primarily unvaccinated COVID-19 cases. The other strain on our healthcare system at the moment is that, as you guys probably heard on the news, Idaho declared crisis standards of care for Northern Idaho. Idaho has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the entire country, and they have seen a hospital surge commensurate with that. And so unfortunately, they did have to move to crisis standards for Northern Idaho, and that is starting to bleed over into Eastern Washington. We're seeing people come to Eastern Washington for medical care, trying to get taken care of. And that affects the entire system. At this point, we are starting to see things turn around a little bit. We're certainly seeing people start to change their behavior. Most of our cases right now are people in their 20s and 30s. We've seen definitely our older population start to be quite a bit more cautious in their indoor gatherings. And I think that is starting to make a difference in our community, but it is early days. And we are still seeing significant strain on our public health and healthcare system. So I would just encourage continuing in that direction. We're seeing a lot more mask wearing going on. I certainly encourage anyone who has not yet been vaccinated to get vaccinated as soon as possible. It is the number one way you can prevent getting hospitalized for this illness and number one way you can prevent dying of this illness. I think it's probably a good idea. We started this a few weeks ago talking about vaccine safety and kind of common misconceptions about the vaccine. And so I wanted to touch base on one that I hear a lot. In young people, one of the biggest reasons I hear for why they might not get vaccinated is one of two things. One, the idea that COVID's not that serious for them. And the thing to know is that with Delta variant, we are seeing more severe infections in young people. We've had to intubate people in their 20s who were otherwise healthy. We've seen children ending up in the ICU with the Delta variant. So it's very different than it was before. You know, your probability of getting severely ill with COVID-19 is still relatively low if you are young and healthy, but the probability of getting severely ill from the vaccine is dramatically lower than that. This is an incredibly safe and well-tested vaccine. The other common misconception I hear about the vaccine is the idea that it might have some effect on fertility. There is no evidence to support this claim. I did a little bit of digging to try to figure out where this comes from. And a lot of it seems to trace back to an early paper out of Japan looking at rats with an injection of a COVID-19 vaccine and just a misinterpretation of that paper. They injected spike protein in a large amount of fat, and in rats they redistribute that fat throughout their body. And so the authors of that paper found that the fat had been redistributed but not the spike protein. But if you ever hear someone say, hey, you know, I heard from a podcast that they found spike protein in ovaries, that's actually where that comes from. It's a misinterpretation of a small study of rats in Japan. They have not found any COVID-19 vaccine in people's ovaries. It does not affect your fertility. In the United States, we actually went on to do a large trial looking at women who were pursuing fertility treatment. And they found that women who got vaccinated and women who did not get vaccinated developed the same number of follicles. They developed the same number of eggs in fertility treatment. So no effect on fertility. And it's very, very safe. What is not safe is COVID-19. With that, I'm happy to take any questions from our commissioners.
You know what, Dr. Berry, I invited Apple Martine to join us. So if you don't mind, I might go ahead and introduce her just because there might be some questions for her as well. Great. On Friday, we had the last day of our former public health director, Vicki Kirkpatrick. She retired after a long career of many decades in public health, and we all wish her well. And we're really pleased to be able to recruit from within the department. And our former director of community health, Apple Martine, has now been appointed the director of Jefferson County Public Health. So welcome, Apple. You're a familiar face to many. We are thrilled you're in this new role. And kind of like we did last week with Jefferson Healthcare, I thought it might be nice for the public to hear a little bit more about what public health does and how things are going at public health. And I want to be brief here to respect everybody's time, but just want to be sure that that you were introduced properly and the important work that your department is doing. So I'll hand it off to you for a few minutes.
Great. Thanks, Commissioner Dean and all the rest of you. This is a meeting that I attend regularly as a viewer and a listener, both on the radio and via video on Monday mornings. And I appreciate all the attendees who commonly listen and check in and tell me how much they enjoy this opportunity to hear all of the good things that are going on to help us stay safe, especially through COVID. I'm Apple Martine. I'm by trade, I'm a nurse. I'm a registered nurse, and I've worked in public health my entire career as a nurse. I had the great fortune to come here 3 years ago to take the Community Health Division Director's position. New leadership for me, and to help steer this team in all kinds of programming, including the many programs we provide direct services for in our community. You may be familiar with our office and our clinic over here on Sheridan Street next to the QFC, and we provide things like WIC nutrition services and sexual reproductive health clinic services, as well as clinics in the schools, immunizations, other communicable disease investigations. Of course, now we are very, very attenuated to the COVID work, and most of our nurses who used to do and still do communicable disease also are doing our COVID work as well. Anyway, there's a lot of programs here, and I've been overseeing that for the last almost 3 years. I have this great opportunity to follow in Vicki Kirkpatrick's footsteps. She is due to a good retirement after 40 years in public health, and it's taught and trained me quite extensively. So my role now is to help continue to bring together the environmental public health sector of our department with the community health sector, which I know very intimately, and have someone come and replace me in that role while I work to synergize our work department-wide. Of course, most of my focus is on COVID at this time, as you well know. And I think Dr. Berry has done a good explanation of all the things that public health is responsible for, but just a reiteration that we are providing self-tests for folks who are symptomatic and or are known as a contact of a positive COVID case. So we're doing that quite extensively out of our building here. We also are 20 months into case investigations and contact tracing, which takes a great deal of time. And we have a very dedicated team who've been working tirelessly all this time to manage that and keep the spread of COVID as low as possible. We're also responsible for educational materials and clarification on guidances to the public. We get lots of questions about that. We work really closely with all the school districts in Jefferson County and work with them hand in hand to figure out policies and roles with regard to helping kids stay safe in school and have access to testing there as well. We also have, and this is a way that the environmental health portion comes into play with COVID, we have a complaints portal for businesses, and we want to make sure that we address each of those complaints, and that is something that we are synergizing over and making sure that we respond to in a relatively reasonable manner and timely manner. There's a lot more to it, but I appreciate all of you welcoming me. It's a big road to hoe right now as a leader in public health, and I really look forward to it.
Thanks so much, Apple. Glad to have you here. All right. So questions for Dr. Berry or Apple, commissioners? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for both of you. Thanks. Great to have you here, Apple, in your new positions. Congratulations, and I'm very happy with the decision. I guess for you, Apple, first, we heard a lot from the hospital district last week about capacity issues and being pushed. And I know that Dr. Berry has reported that our case contact tracing is kind of in a triage mode. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit about overcapacity and, how public health is doing, specifically community public health, and what do you need? What can people do to help?
Yeah, I appreciate the inquiry. It's been a tough road for us to figure out how to have the bandwidth for this. And there's definitely thresholds. We are just people, and we are really trying to manage other people's needs. And they're very complex needs. Managing folks in isolation and quarantine is something that we take a lot of pride in, and we work very hard at to manage those and make sure that people are able to be compliant, able to work through their symptoms and get better and not spread into the community. And we have had little spread in the community until recently. So the Delta variant has, presented us with a whole new paradigm. And I think we've shifted rather well. That being said, We draw for case and contact tracing across our entire department. So we have folks from environmental public health as well as community health. That's nurses, that's environmental specialists. We have people from across our department working on what we call a bench so that we rotate week to week in order to get extra help for our COVID response team, which is comprised of four people currently. We will be looking for a fifth person, and that is to come. It's a little difficult to onboard a lot more new people in the middle of a surge. We certainly weren't expecting that August and early September would be this pronounced in terms of the need for us. So we have struggled. It's certainly nothing to hide. This is a lot of work. Healthcare workers and public health workers, we are taxed. People, you know, they're tired, and we have a lot of incoming questions that can be hard to tamp down because we understand that people are confused or eager, frustrated, or angry. And so we're managing with extra help out front to answer phones. We're looking for different ways to manage the incoming questions mostly so that our communicable disease team, our COVID team, and the volunteers that help there can manage their work as effectively as possible. I think, you know, you all had been suggestive and also supportive of extra COVID nurse positions. We've gotten one filled and it's worked out very wonderfully. And we will fill the second one. We just are pressing pause on it for this moment so that we can recollect and make sure that we onboard someone with the right detailed orientation.
And I would say, you know, from the public's end, the biggest thing you can do to support the COVID response is get vaccinated and wear a mask. But beyond that, knowing that our capacity, we used to really pride ourselves on being available for questions from the community immediately. You know, we would take a call and we'd get you everything you need. And just because of the sheer number of cases, we can't do that the same way that we used to. And so I would really encourage folks, if you test positive for COVID-19, especially on a home test, so you don't have a healthcare interaction, definitely log on to our website. You can also look, our Facebook page is relatively popular, and we've got a good flow sheet of where to go. So say you test positive, what do you do? Or say your friend told you that they had COVID and they might have exposed you, what do you do? Start there. And then if you still haven't gotten all of your answers, then give us a call and we'll help you through. A lot of times right now we're getting calls that if you take a minute, take a breath and look online first, you can often solve that question. But we know it's scary to test positive for COVID, and it makes it really hard to navigate the process. And of course, remember that your healthcare professionals are here to support you as well. They are strained, but we are happy to help you. And we're happy to help make sure that you don't end up in the hospital if we can. So especially if you test positive, and you are at high risk of progressing to severe disease. So if you're over 65 and you test positive for COVID, there are treatments available to you. Or if you have, you know, advanced diabetes and you test positive for COVID, we do have monoclonal antibody therapy available in Jefferson County for those high risk folks. And so please do engage with your primary care provider. We can help get you that therapy to try to keep you from getting in the hospital.
And if I could follow up with you, Dr. Barry, thank you for that clarification. I'm wondering if personally, we should start going back to pods and things like that where we're really limiting our interaction. I mean, it's great that the curve is slowing, but it's still going up. And it's, you know, every week a new record for infections and deaths is not the kind of trend I want to continue. So what can we do personally to contribute to arresting that climb?
Yeah, I do think, especially if you're in a high-risk group, and now would be a good time to bring back the pod. So if you're over 65, even if you're fully vaccinated, I think, you know, having a small group of people that you interact with indoors who are also fully vaccinated is a really good idea. If you are unvaccinated, it's really important for you to minimize that interaction with other folks. The risk of exposure and transmitting COVID is so high. But I would say, you know, limiting our social interactions is a good idea. That doesn't mean don't socialize. You know, I've got a pod myself. I've just stayed in my pod because I live in the COVID world. And so I wasn't quite ready to let that go yet. But I still have, you know, close people that I interact with. You can get that socialization, but you want it to be a stable group of people that you interact with over time. And fully vaccinated spaces are much safer than not fully vaccinated spaces. So it's still very reasonable to go into indoor spaces with fully vaccinated groups of people, but really limit your times in in places where unvaccinated and fully vaccinated people are mixing indoors. That's a high risk space right now.
And then just to follow up on that, you know, I'm itching for a game of poker, which I have not had in 2 years, and would love to get some people together. So if we have some, you know, unvaccinated friends that want to join that game, and we want to do it inside, this is the weather's getting a little cold. If those unvaccinated folks wear masks, is that appropriate? Or is this, would you recommend that we just have a vaccinated only? I mean, there's still 70% of the adults. I'm not, we can still
get it. You mean there's always gradations of safety. So your safest is a fully vaccinated crew. If for whatever reason you can't find poker players who aren't really vaccinated, if you make sure everyone has to have a mask on when you start mixing vaccinated and unvaccinated folks. So in those masks on, being around the table, open some windows, get some ventilation, all those kind of things can make it a much safer gathering.
Great. Thank you very much.
Heidi, do you have any questions?
I've seen the long list of written questions that we have, and I want to defer for time for those. Many of those questions answer things that have come up in my life. I just wanted to share how much support you have in our community, Dr. Berry. I am getting flooded with it. So, you know, when people complain about all the comments and well, I should be complaining to you because I'm spending most of my time fielding support for Dr. Berry right now. And I just want to pass that along and make sure that you know that your community is behind you, because we are.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. That's really kind.
I hope you're seeing that too, Dr. Berry. Are you also receiving the many, many emails that we are?
I am getting some love from Jefferson County, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Glad to hear.
So yes, we have a lot of questions today. I'm going to try to go through as many as I can while not moving too fast. I've gotten that feedback before too. So we'll see what we can do. So one is about full approval versus EUAs. So quick review, the EUA still requires an extensive amount of data, still very safe. But the Pfizer vaccine 16 and up has gotten full approval. The questioner asked why not 12 to 15? And the primary reason is just time. So you need even more data to get to a full approval. And if we remember way back, Pfizer was approved back in December and then was approved for 12 to 15 in May. They need a couple more months of data in the 12 to 15 bracket before they can move to full approval, but that's likely coming in the next few months. So it's just a time lag issue. Still very, very safe in 12 to 15 and strongly recommended. We do still have only 40% of our kids fully vaccinated who are eligible. The more kids we have vaccinated in that group, the more likely we can keep schools safely open and reduce transmission. So really strongly encourage vaccination in that group. There is no age bracket in which it is safer to get COVID-19 than it is to get a vaccine. Absolutely get the kids vaccinated. As soon as my daughter can get vaccinated, I can guarantee she will be. It's a really good thing to do for kids and for parents. One question was about travel. So you've got in this particular question, talking about fully vaccinated folks who recently returned from a European vacation. What do you do as far as those visitors? I think it's important to note there is a big difference about whether or not your friends are fully vaccinated. If you have friends who recently traveled and they are unvaccinated, that is high risk. I would definitely give them some space for a good 10 to 14 days after they come back. But if they are fully vaccinated, the risk is much, much lower, especially if they did other safe things. You know, so they wore their masks on the plane, they wore a good quality mask, they weren't going to, you know, large indoor festivals when they were traveling. So I would encourage talking to your friends. It depends on what they did. If it was low risk travel, they're fully vaccinated, there's not really anything different that you need to do. But unvaccinated travel is very high risk right now. So especially that comes into play if either your friends are unvaccinated or if they traveled with unvaccinated kids. So if they've got kids under 12, that is higher risk, and you want to give them a little space until they've been back for about 10 to 14 days. With infections rising so rapidly in Jefferson County, what are we doing to address the possibility of running out of hospital beds? So we're working on a lot of different realms to try to work on that. So one is, you know, the work we're doing right now to try to reduce infections. That's why we put in the new health order on high-risk indoor spaces, is really to protect healthcare capacity and to protect our schools. Other things we're doing, of course, our case and contact tracing is a big part of it. The partnership with Jefferson Healthcare to deliver monoclonal antibodies to the long-term care facility outbreak is another part of it. One of the biggest drivers of hospitalizations is these infections among high-risk people, long-term care being one of the highest risk. And so we plan to continue that monoclonal antibody delivery to try to reduce hospitalizations. Making sure that we have monoclonal antibodies for people who are high risk is another big one. But as far as hospital capacity itself, we work very closely with the hospital on surge capacity planning. So making sure that we have the ability to scale up beds if we need it. The biggest challenge, though, is staffing. We can't create more people, can't create more trained people. We are working closely with the EOC on potentially activating medical volunteer corps members, but that is a challenge too. Most of our volunteer corps is over 65. And so activating for a COVID response is particularly risky. And so we aren't counting on a lot more people. We're certainly making the surge plans to manage as best we can. And unfortunately, we've had to use those surge plans a lot in Clallam County. And so we're used to doing it. And we can activate that experience if we need it. But largely, we're going to be limited in how many more beds and people we can move. The other major thing that we are doing there is we're reducing other parts of the staff. So Jefferson Healthcare has stopped elective surgeries for the last couple weeks. That's not because we don't want to do those surgeries. We do. We know people who are in pain need those surgeries, but it's to free that staff up to work the ICU. In truth, surgical staff are really good at the ICU, and that's most of what we're doing there. We would love to get back to those kind of things, but we can only get back there when the case rates slow down even more. That's most of what we're doing related to hospital capacity. We also have surge plans to pull people from other parts of the clinic and healthcare system. So basically, we move people to higher risk areas, but that always means less service somewhere else. Of the recent COVID cases of fully vaccinated individuals, is there any data on which vaccine they had? I don't have that breakdown for Jefferson County, but I can tell you statewide, it's roughly equivalent to the percentages of those vaccines that were delivered. We're not seeing more breakthrough with any one vaccine over another. The primary driver of breakthrough is not actually vaccine failure. It's the just sheer number of infections and the high viral load we're getting exposed to in the community. The other driver of it is the risk status of the person who got the vaccine. So if you are older, particularly we see over 75, it's not actually even over 65, over 75, we know your immune system cannot respond as well to any vaccine, including the COVID vaccine. And so unfortunately, we're not seeing as strong of an immune response in that group. And certainly folks who have underlying immunodeficiency or people who are very, very ill. So our folks who live in long-term care are our most vulnerable to COVID-19, and unfortunately the least able to respond to their vaccine. That's the primary driver of vaccine breakthrough. And there's a later question actually about vaccine breakthrough percentages. So in Jefferson County, our vaccine breakthrough percentage is about 22%, which feels high compared to what we're seeing other places. Clallam's breakthrough percentage is 9%. I can, as far as kind of how that has changed over time, if you've been following the numbers, it's been kind of stair-stepping up for the last few months. The primary reason for that is not still, as we've discussed, vaccine failure, but just the sheer number of exposures that we're getting. That is actually the expected amount of vaccine breakthrough in a highly vaccinated community. If the vast majority of your people are vaccinated, then the infections you get are likely to be in vaccinated people. Still, the majority of our infections are in unvaccinated people, but you see a higher percentage just because so many of us are vaccinated. But what the vaccine is doing for us is it's making less of us go to the hospital, less of us die, and it's also reducing our total number of infections. So, you know, as we've discussed before, the best way to look at the efficacy of the vaccine is the difference between what you're seeing in Clallam and what you're seeing in Jefferson. And that's a 12% difference between our vaccine coverage. And that really makes all the difference. So you'll see a higher percent of breakthrough, but your total number of infections is dramatically lower if you have more vaccinated people. Is it advisable to go to church where we have the doors open, sit apart, and are masked? The singers and speakers are unmasked throughout most of the service. So this kind of gets at your higher risk spaces. So we've talked about before, churches are a somewhat high risk space, especially if they don't require vaccines to go in. It does sound like the church you're describing is doing a lot of good safety protocols. And we have not seen large outbreaks related to churches that are doing that. So if your folks in church are masked, if they're spaced out, if they've opened the windows, that's a much safer space to be. But you do, it sounds like you've been paying close attention to the COVID safety. And so there is one high risk activity there, which
recording is, stopped.
Which is singing without a mask on. And so I think it would be reasonable to raise the question about whether or not that singer is vaccinated. If your cantor is vaccinated, then much, much lower risk if you can. And otherwise, creating a good space between that singer and the parishioners makes all the difference. We have seen COVID-19 travel, you know, 15, 30 feet when people are singing unmasked. So you need a good space between you and that person. We have seen it kind of travel to the front rows when that happens. But otherwise, if everybody's masked and spaced out, that's a relatively safe space. Then as far as your own personal decisions, it really depends on your own personal risk. So if you are very high risk, if you're 85, if you've got cancer, now would probably not be a time to even go to a church like that, because it's a high risk time to be indoors. But if you are relatively healthy, relatively young, I think that can be done well. But that's a personal decision for each person. But that's kind of some of the things that I would weigh if I was in that position. Is it advisable to stay in hotels on the peninsula? I am traveling by myself and choosing hotels that have a thorough cleaning process. So the hotels themselves are actually pretty safe. We don't see much transmission from surfaces, as we've discussed. It's really the shared indoor spaces. So staying in a hotel is okay. What I would not recommend doing is spending a whole lot of time in the lobby. So come in, check in, go to your room, and don't gather in indoor spaces unless they're fully vaccinated indoor spaces. Let's see. I was told by someone, a healthcare provider, that she was immune because she had COVID over 4 months ago. Is this accurate? Great question. So this gets at the idea of kind of prior immunity versus vaccine. One of the challenges is prior immunity from COVID infection is highly variable. So some people remain immune for 6 months at least to COVID-19 if they've had it before. Other people have very little immunity at all, and it's really hard to figure out which one you're going to be. So if you've had COVID in the past, it does not guarantee that you're immune to COVID now. We certainly have had reinfections in our community. And so if you've had COVID before, it is still recommended that you get the vaccine. One thing that we know is if you've had COVID and then get vaccinated, you are very well covered, and that the vaccine is still very, very safe for you. So we do recommend getting the vaccine. You cannot guarantee that you're immune from prior COVID infection. You may be, but you also may not be. Particularly we see this if you've had milder infections. So young people with mild infections, we're seeing not having continuous immunity down the road. So do please still get vaccinated. Feel free to send that healthcare worker to us and we'll talk to them about the pros of vaccination and answer any questions that they might have. I was told by someone that cloth masks are no longer considered sufficient against Delta. Would wearing a surgical mask plus a cloth mask be a better choice? So it depends a lot on the quality of your cloth mask. So we've discussed this a little bit before. Tight weave, multiple layers close to your face can still actually be pretty good. But a surgical mask is generally going to be better protection for most people as long as it fits your face well. So that's most of what I use in any kind of high risk setting. That's certainly what I use at work. But if I'm just going to the grocery store where I know that I'm not going to be there for a really long period of time, cloth masks can work just fine. Really, it comes down to how tight's the weave. It's got to have two or more layers. It's got to be close against your face. If you have that, it's good. But if you can see, you know, sunshine through it, if you hold it up to a window, not a good mask. And if it's only one layer or it doesn't fit your face well, also not a good mask. But surgical masks are a good option for protection, and I recommend them. In most cases, the public doesn't need an N95. But for things like potentially flying, those higher risk spaces, KN95s can be a good option for those spaces. Speaking of travel, please comment on the difficulties with getting testing for travel purposes within the 72-hour window. So this is an important question, I think, for people to know about. There are shortages of testing state and nationwide. We've worked really hard to build up capacity in Jefferson County in particular. You know, the Jefferson Healthcare has worked very closely. The public health department is giving out tests to people who are exposed to COVID-19. There's a lot of work going into increasing capacity, but every resource is finite and tests are among those. And so because of the surge of demand we're seeing, not just here, but across the state and the nation, we're seeing turnaround times get long again. So even for people who are sick and really need that result to know whether or not they have COVID so that we can contact trace them, for send out tests, things that we can't do at Jefferson Healthcare that we send out, we're often seeing them return within about 72 hours. So I wanna acknowledge the challenge of trying to get tested to travel and trying to hit that window. A lot of people are not hitting that window right now. And it is primarily just that the system is over capacity. So too many people are needing testing. And I think it is important to acknowledge there is a group that really, really needs to get tested, and that is those who are sick. And every other test we add to the system does delay that turnaround for them. And so I would be thoughtful about travel right now. It is putting an additional strain on the system. And if we can avoid it, I think it's a good idea right now. Really save those tests for the people who need them the most. I do have more questions. I can try to do a couple more. I don't want to take all of Willie's time. let me see if I can get a couple more in, and then I'll pass it to Willie. Do you agree with the WHO regarding booster shots? Should the vaccine be used for people who have not had the opportunity to get vaccinated rather than giving those fully vaccinated a third dose? Generally, yes. I do agree with the WHO. I think it is important to remember that there are many countries in this world that have 1% or less of their population vaccinated. I've done a lot of work in Kenya, and I have friends who work in the hospital, and they haven't gotten a single vaccine yet. And so there are people who need these vaccines more than we do. There are a couple exceptions to that, though. So if you are a person who likely didn't fully respond to your first two doses, I do recommend you get a third dose. So if you have active cancer, if you're immunosuppressed, anyone in that group, I do recommend you get your third dose. That's a good idea. There is discussion of boosters for some high-risk folks, so particularly people in long-term care, and people over the age of 75 who likely didn't fully respond to their first two doses. That is a group that, if that becomes approved, I will definitely encourage vaccination in that group. That group is not yet approved by the FDA. Right now, it's only immunosuppressed people. So if you fall into that category, please do get your shots. Right now, we don't have the evidence to say that people younger than 75 need a booster. We just don't have that showing up yet. And so I think we really need to We do need to prioritize getting those vaccines to people who haven't had a chance yet. This one's probably important to touch on, and then I'll pass it to Willie. So this person said the Clallam County Sheriff assured protesters that his office would not be enforcing mask mandates, according to the PDN. So probably worth touching on. So I know Sheriff Benedict really well. We worked very closely on the COVID-19 response. He called me after that PDN story ran and let me know that that was not how he intended that to come across. So he actually does support the recent order. What he was trying to convey was that the order is written such that it doesn't involve the sheriff's office. The primary enforcement mechanism is the revocation of permits, which doesn't involve law enforcement at all. He was giving those remarks in the midst of a pretty scary protest. And I think that probably affected the way that they were delivered. But right now, the way that the order is written, it doesn't involve his office. If, however, someone comes into a business and, you know, refuses to wear a mask or refuses to leave when they're asked for their vaccination status, then he would get involved. Law enforcement would get involved. But he actually is not. I know it came across that way. He's actually not against the order. It just doesn't involve his office as far as enforcement goes. So with that, I will pass it to Willie.
Can I follow up with one question real quick, Dr. Yeah. Perry? And that's how has it been received in Jefferson County, the mask mandate in restaurants and bars? I mean, is there anything that you want to speak to about how restaurants are handling it?
So yeah, we've heard kind of a mix across the county. I have heard from a lot of restaurant owners that they were very nervous the first weekend, you know, especially with some of the feedback we were getting publicly about it. Mainly nervous about people, you know, being unkind to their staff, being violent to their staff, and we've not seen that happen. We have seen, by and large, most people have just shown their vaccine card when they get there, and in fact, many restaurants have seen an increase in demand for their services from folks who didn't feel safe going to restaurants before and now do. And so I think it's gone a lot better than a lot of people feared that it would. I've definitely heard from folks who they feel grateful. They wanted to go to a restaurant before, but they didn't feel safe and now they can. And so anytime we do something new, there's an adjustment period. And certainly our staff at Public Health have spent the last week just assisting businesses with how to go about the order. We have not done any enforcement yet. We thought it was best to really just give people support for this first week. This next week, we would start enforcing against businesses who are not participating in the order. And generally how that works is we do reach out to the business. We always try to get voluntary compliance first, answer any questions that they have. And then if they're not willing to, we give them 72 hours to fix the violation. And then we can start revoking permits after that. And we would if they don't make any changes. One way that they could get into compliance if they don't want to start checking vaccine status is they just move to takeout only or outdoor dining only. And so for some businesses, that might be a more manageable option, but we'll be working with them on that this week. When it comes to new staffing challenges, I think that plays out here too. We have a tiny staff, and so we will be triaging complaints, but we do take complaints from the public. We add them to the queue and we prioritize them based on risk. And so if you've reported to us that a business is doing it and you haven't seen anything happen yet, might be because it was the first week and we're gonna give people some time to get on board. But now we're just gonna be prioritizing them from there. So we will eventually get to everybody.
Thank you. And William, sorry to say, we only have a few minutes with KPTZ and we do have an executive session at 10:30. So we'll have to be a little bit brief.
Yep. No worries at all. I have a relatively brief report today as always. We had our first immunosuppressed clinic this past weekend. It was in Chimacum. We had 78 individuals who, for whatever reason, their immune systems weren't able to create a strong enough reaction to their first two-dose series. So it was recommended that they get a third dose. And we had 78 folks come through. So a big thank you to my vaccine operations team for making that happen. We'll be back in action this coming Saturday from 9 to noon. At Blue Heron in Port Townsend. Again, it's only open to folks who are immunosuppressed. You can find out exactly what that means on the Jefferson County Public Health website, or give us a call at 344-9791 and we can talk you through what that's like. We have about 40 folks signed up for that specific clinic. We have room for lots more. And we do require you to pre-register beforehand. So do go to the Public Health website, give us a call here at the EOC. We do want to get you registered beforehand. And again, it is important for those folks to get that third dose so that they do get the most complete protection. Other than that, we do have a couple of private clinics to assist employers and their employees in meeting the upcoming vaccine mandate. October 4th is your last day to get your vaccine to be fully vaccinated in time for that October 18th deadline. So employees out there working for an employer who falls under the state's vaccine mandate, you'll need to get your Johnson & Johnson shot by October 4th to be fully vaccinated by October 18th. So any employees out there who are, you know, kind of waiting to the last minute with this vaccine mandate, again, please do give us a call. We can get you set up and get you an appointment there. Other than that, we remain at the ready. We're targeting clinics for 5 to 12-year-olds as soon as that is approved. We're still doing planning for booster doses for the general population once that's approved. And then other than that, we are looking at our medical volunteers and ways we can support Jefferson Healthcare. We can support public health, offsetting some of their work through that medical volunteer corps. It is, as Dr. Berry alluded to, it is really difficult, given the difficult nature of the work, some of the inherent risk in the work, and the age group, some of the vulnerabilities of our volunteer pool. So I made a call for volunteers last week. We did get a few new volunteers into the pool, so I'll do the very same thing again, especially if you're willing to work long hours. That's a big difficulty for our volunteer corps right now. Many of them can't remain standing. Many of them also have health issues of their own or health issues at home that they don't want to work in a potentially risky environment, even though we'll provide them full PPE, take adequate protections that have protected healthcare workers throughout this pandemic. Many are a little bit nervous about stepping forward. But if you can work long hours, if you're willing to put yourself in one of those environments, have a medical background, please do get in touch with us. We can definitely use you. Other than that, it's 10:30, so I will end my report there, barring any quick questions. Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, let's not forget our influenza vaccine. I got my shot this weekend, but, you know, we're focused on COVID, but flu's a threat, and, you know, people ought to get vaccinated against the flu.
Yes, please do. Flu shots are starting to be available in pharmacies around town. We definitely, one of the best ways to keep folks out of the hospital is to not get influenza. So please do get vaccinated soon. It will help as we move into the fall.
Question, I'm not sure who it's for, any of you. Are we seeing an uptick in vaccinations like we're seeing nationwide due to mandates or a greater sense of risk?
I'd say we're seeing a slow rise in vaccinations here. I think we expect a small surge related to the governor's mandate soon. A lot of folks seem to be waiting until that last 2 weeks to get vaccinated. I would encourage folks not to wait. It really makes, you know, it would make a difference to get vaccinated now. We're gonna have to do it either way. Might as well get protected sooner rather than later. But we've not seen a massive surge, but we are seeing a rise. And we're certainly as Commissioner Dean mentioned, nationwide, we are seeing a rise related to the mandates.
Other questions? All right, well, thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate your time and efforts. We'll see you next week.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And don't forget, a recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening. I would like to say thank you to Dr. Berry, to Willie Bentz, and the commissioners for outstanding work. We are very lucky to have them right here in our community. Again, thank you all.